RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
David Charalambos is a renowned expert in communication and influence with a background of 25 years in consulting. He is the founder of Reaching People, a project focused on helping individuals have honest and open dialogue, particularly in situations where people hold differing views. You can go to reachingpeople.net to find out more. They're also on X and other platforms. And David will be in person, one of the key speakers at the NZD SOS conference. The theme of the conference this year, changing the prevailing health narrative in New Zealand and empowering change. David will be speaking about the psychological forces at play in decision-making and behavior, offering practical insights into ethical influence and effective communication. And David is with us ahead of his arrival in New Zealand to talk about this on RCR. David, welcome to the radio station, and hopefully we can welcome you in person at the conference that you'll be coming to.
Thank you, Paul, and I'm very much looking forward to it.
First question, what gets someone interested in behavioral science, David?
Well, my initial interest was really in behavior and basically understanding people. So it goes back to when I was 25, I was made a CIO of a company because I'd done really well in systems. Mm. And I suddenly realized I didn't understand people.
So right.
That really, because at that point, you've got to deal with a lot of people. And I realized everyone else understood what was going on. So yeah, that was a rude awakening for me at that point.
How long has this science been around as an actual science?
Well, it's kind of matured. I mean, understanding behavior and communication probably is since the dawn of time.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah.
But I think there was really a point a few decades ago where it appears that they stopped listening to people and started watching them.
Right.
And that's when they really, because what happens is when you really get into the depths of it, we don't always understand why we do things. Okay, a lot of that's a mystery to us. And, you know, some people know themselves better than others. But when we fill out surveys and when we tell people why we're doing things, we don't know whether that's accurate. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But behavior science stopped listening to people and it just started watching them, and it started creating some elaborate, very clever studies to work out why we actually did certain things.
Mm.
And that's why it's both a very big opportunity for, you know, for humankind, but it's also a very dangerous time because they can influence us without us knowing that we're being influenced.
Yeah, that's kind of scary. Where in the human is behavior generated? Because, I mean, we all have gut feelings. We have feelings from the heart. And I guess we have, you know, intellectual processes as well. Is it all of the above, or is there any sort of specific primary generator of behavior?
Well, there's a lot of sort of compelling evidence that consciousness developed quite late in the process.
Mm.
So a lot of our primary instincts are in a part of our mind that are not conscious to us. So, for instance, when we have these primal things for safety, control, to have approval, all of these things. But when you do something, you don't generally go, oh, I'm going to do that because I need to get approval from other people.
Mm.
Just do it because it feels like the right thing to do. That makes sense. So a lot of it's really for efficiency. So if I went to shake your hand, you would actually reach out your hand, but you would shake my hand without thinking about doing it. Does that make sense? So for, you know, to make life easier, we automate a lot of our behavior. Once we've automated it, we don't think about it. We just do it automatically. And that's part of the problem, because if we're conditioned to do certain behaviors that are not in our best interest, a lot of the time we won't notice because they're so automatic. And this is where the schooling system has a lot to be responsible in that realm.
So you can form people's behavior, but as far as they're concerned, it's formed by themselves.
Well, you can, yeah, but we influence each other all the time, you know, quite naturally. The problem is that if a group of people understand the conditions which creates a behavior, they can create the false conditions. So for instance, you know about Pavlov's dogs with the bell. It's an age old study. Well, at school, you know, because that's classical conditioning and that's how we learn a lot of things. So at school, you're phrased, if you do as you're told, and you're told off if you don't do as you're told. And then and people end up taking that into adult life, but they never really question anything because it doesn't feel good to do so.
Talking about that moment earlier where they started watching, they started observing, I think is kind of how you put it. So what sort of observation would have taken place there? It's like a complete breakdown of how people behave to some kind of manual that can be then used?
Well, yeah. Well, there's plenty of manuals out there now, and there's certainly one given to government departments. But there was really a lot of social science studies that occurred. I mean, one of the famous ones is called it's the study of the theology students. It's called the Good Samaritan study. And effectively, they split a group of theology students into three different groups, and they told each group a slightly different thing. They told the first group they were in a rush. They told the second group they were on time. They told the third group that they had plenty of time. And they were told they were given a sermon about the Good Samaritan in the adjacent building. And then they were told to go over there. Now, they placed an actor on the journey who was groaning and moaning and in need of assistance. And bearing in mind, these people are just about to go and give a sermon on the Good Samaritan. They then measured, of the three different groups, who stopped. And it turned out that the first group, I think it was only 11% stopped, and the last group, 65% of them stopped.
Right.
So by manipulating being in a rush versus not being in a rush, they had a massive difference in people's behavior. So that was time. But they've done it on so many different things that you've almost got this checklist of, if we change this variable, we're going to see a difference in behavior. That makes sense. So they can almost create the conditions.
In the example you've just given, time, that's really interesting. Compressing time, speeding things up, then limits thoughtful decision-making.
Yeah, well, they said that it narrowed the cognitive map, and it just got the person focused so much on getting to the place that they noticed less things in their environment. And obviously, you've probably heard of the given bread and circus and they won't revolt. It's kind of, you know, it's very interesting how our minds operate. But from one moment to the next, we won't always notice that they're operating under a different circumstance.
When things started to happen, what would we say, 2020, 2021?
Yeah.
With the knowledge that you have built up over many years, you could see what was about to happen, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, I was actually expecting something like that anyway, because I purchased a property in about 2013 with a group of other people in New Zealand, funny enough, because we were thinking, if the world goes a bit crazy, we can head there. But it turned out to be one of the worst places affected. So, but yeah, a lot of plans. For instance, if you build a hotel, you have to build the foundations. Okay. The hotel doesn't just turn up. You just can't build it in a day. So effectively, if you look at whatever foundations are being built, you can pretty much predict what's going on. So a lot of people now know that the WEF and certain groups have a lot of plans, and those plans don't just happen overnight. So you can check if these plans are coming along. So yeah, pretty much from day one, I was completely suspect. It wasn't at any point did I think it was a real big threat.
Did it follow the pattern that you thought it would?
It was actually much worse. I don't think anyone could have predicted the craziness that occurred. I mean, if you would have wrote a fictional novel, no one would have published it because they said it's too unbelievable. And it was really in March 2020 when all the craziness was happening, and I suddenly realized that my skills needed updating, because they had done something to the psyche of people, because I couldn't have a rational conversation with anyone, you know, which was very unusual because of all the study I'd done. I consider myself a good debater. So literally I had to delve back into the research again. And it was very revealing, to be honest.
Yeah, I think many of us have had that experience and wondered even with empirical information. Here it is. I'm showing it to you. It's right in front of your face. It reminds me of, you know, the church people who wouldn't look in the telescope, you know, Galileo's telescope, because they didn't want to see. Yeah. And I got to say, that really surprises me, because anything else, they would look, they would listen.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, facts generally don't change people's minds, or certainly raw facts don't. And the problem is that when someone's already had their mind tampered with, any evidence contrary to what they believe tends to be rejected. And that's the problem, especially when there was a lot of, I mean, those people dropping dead in the street was a very thought out media coverage, because that affects the person at an emotional subconscious level really deeply. And then if you try to rationalize with the person, it's not going to work.
Because they fear for their life.
Yeah, because the primal, because what you've got, you've effectively got, there's really two minds in us, and you could talk that there's three different brains, etc. But there's two things going on. There's the unconscious and the conscious, and there's two different processes. And the unconscious primary goal is to keep us safe. So if that's witnessed an event that looks like it's a threat to survival, it will become very important to it. And this is why if the media can fake a situation, it does look like that one was probably faked, because not another single person ever dropped dead in the street from COVID. That is so important, because the brain will look at that just as it would, you know, see a snake and all these other things. And it's such a deep imprint that when you try to rationalize with numbers, it will have no effect.
Yeah, I was watching some of the debate between Trump and Kamala Harris a day or so ago. And this thing, and I've just remembered this from what you're saying, this thing about Charlotte, when there were protests against statues being removed, and there were, you know, a whole melting pot of protesters. And he said there were good people on both sides. The media played that. But following on from that is his explanation of that, which clearly shows he wasn't favoring, you know, the neo-Nazis. Yet it seems to me that people have it so locked in that that's what he said. And you can say, because I've tried it before, No, that's only part of the clip. If you watch the whole thing, you'll understand what was being said. But even that, I can't even cope with that. So
yeah,
here's an example.
Yeah, well, you see, the media is one of the most powerful institutions in the world. It pretty much can shape what people believe. And it's quite fascinating how many people really can be conditioned to hate someone so quickly. And look at the hatred towards Trump and Putin and all these people. And I'm not saying they're good or bad. I don't think, having not met the people, it's hard to judge. But the media does such a successful role. But they never really seem to say much bad about the oppositions. You know, the Zelenskys and the Kamala Harris never really get any bad press. And that should set off warning bells for most people.
I want to talk about nudging.
Yeah.
Because I guess it's all in the word. Nothing too strong, just subtle nudges to get people moving in a particular direction. That's a really smart way to do it, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you see, Richard Thaler wrote the book called Nudge. And having listened to him speak, I think he's actually got pretty decent ethics, but I think he's quite naive, thinking that institutions and governments are not going to use this in an unethical way. And they clearly are. And you know, there's plenty of nudges going on. There's blatant pushes as well. But yeah, it's a very fascinating thing that goes on in the nudge, because it's pretty much everywhere now in the UK government. It's ubiquitous through every department.
Yeah, that's the what's known as the Behavioural Insights Team, right? That's
yes.
The team behind the nudging.
Yeah.
And that's been there for a while.
Oh, for a long while, it was David Cameron that put it in the UK government. I think it was 2011. I mean, that was the first official department. I think it has been around a lot longer than that. But yeah, they're pretty much, they try to justify what they're doing as being, you know, a good use of it. And they talk about, you know, helping people's health and et cetera, et cetera. But when you look at the actual use of it, it doesn't appear to be used in the public's interest, in my opinion.
Would it be fair to say it has been or was weaponized against the public?
Well, yeah, and some of the actual authors talk about weapons of influence. You know, kind of show off. That's how it is. But yeah, you're completely right. It has been weaponized, and it's been weaponized. And the thing is with a nudge, is that if you want to influence your kids to eat better or to study better, and you do it in a way that they feel empowered, then that's you know, you could argue that's good use of influence. But when you're influencing someone to do something for your benefit, not for their benefit, then that's a manipulation. And that's how it's primarily used by the looks of it.
And it's been, fair to say, very successful. It worked. Oh,
yeah, it's off the charts successful. And it's also, for the most part, stealth.
Right.
I mean, you look at some of the... I'm going to say a sentence now, and I guarantee that you've experienced it numerous times, okay? Somebody's had a medical procedure and then they catch the actual disease they're supposed to be protected from and they go, I'm so glad I had that, otherwise it would have been so much worse.
Oh, like a stuck record, David.
Yeah, how many times you heard that? Right, now that is, now the person that's saying that is under the illusion that that is their thought.
Right. Okay?
But it's not, it's been placed there. And it's been placed there in a very subtle way using what's known as the cognitive dissonance process. Because what happens is if you've had something to protect you from something, okay, and then you get that thing, you're at a point now where two thoughts don't match. Yeah. And then you've got, you pretty much should turn around and say, well, this, you know, this jab doesn't work. But that's going to be uncomfortable. So what they do is they give the person another way out.
Right.
And they say, oh, No, it is working. Just like when they said, oh, if you get sick, it's working. Well, hang on a minute.
We heard that from our Prime Minister. If you've had any sort of reaction, it means it's working even better, kind of thing.
Yeah, which is...
It's insane.
They're just guiding people. Oh, it's insane. They're basically, that's really what predictive programming is. They're guiding people's thoughts. They're controlling their mind. But what happens is the mind will be under the illusion that it's actually, that's come from itself. And you look at people, that's one of a dozen or so conditioned thoughts into people. And when these people say this to you, like, you know, if someone will say to you, why are you not having it? And you explain it to them, and then you say, why are you having it? So I trust the science. I believe in science. And it's like, well, where are you following it? Mm. You know what I mean? They can't, when you go past that level, they really don't know.
I found even saying, well, it's untested and I would never trust anything that hasn't been tested properly that's going into my body, which I would have thought was a slam dunk. But
yeah,
that didn't even kind of register as the answer, not trying to make it about me, but we all have personal experiences. The answer was something like, well, are you prepared to risk everybody for that?
Well, that's because they ran a large-scale study prior to the pandemic working out which messages would be the most persuasive, and guilt was pretty much the number one. So they used that extensively. So what happens is when the person is, you know, emotionally manipulated to do something, when they say to you, oh, are you not going to protect everyone else? That's them trying to rationalize what's going on. There's no real logical argument to that, because if it doesn't stop transmission, which shouldn't be the only reason anyway, I mean, we should all have complete body autonomy of ourselves.
Yeah.
But the fact that it didn't stop transmission, all of the logical arguments had no basis, yet that didn't stop people using them.
How come some of us were immune to this persuasion?
Now, there's the $64,000 question. To answer that in depth would take a good few days, but it's effectively your prior experiences. So what you have is the way that we think is not entirely accurate. So basically the way they've educated us on how our brain works isn't completely true. So most of the work that's done in your brain is done in like an engine room that's hidden from you, and then you end up with conclusions. Now, the reason that you came to better conclusions because you've exposed yourself to better quality information. Okay, you spotted over the years that certain people are not telling the truth, and then you've gone to other places to get your information. So in that kind of melting pot of information, you've put a lot better quality in there, and then you come to a different conclusion. Now, if you've had experiences in the past, such as I had, which I had an experience when I was 19, which led me to not trust doctors anymore, then, you know, your belief system completely changes. And it's a bit like a hallway of mirrors. If you imagine that all your beliefs are like mirrors, when something comes in, it bounces off all of them and it comes out with an answer. Okay. If someone trusts that there's checks and balances in government, they trust that scientists can't be manipulated, all these things, then they could well believe that, you know, the politicians were telling the truth when we clearly know they were not.
What about the scientists, the scientific community themselves? Surely they are empowered with knowledge and information built up over careers to follow the science, as they say, analyze data, to take everything in and never make judgments, because it's always open to someone else coming along and blowing your theory, your idea out of the water. But there seemed to be a lockstep in that area.
Well, there's, you see, the more educated someone is, then the more rationalization they have to believe things that aren't true. So there's a big part of the science community which, you know, the information they've been told, a lot of it, you know, you would question. But they're not as big a critical thinkers as you'd think, a lot of them. I mean, the ones that are standing up clearly are, you know, and we've seen a lot of them stand up and talk about things that don't add up. But if you're getting paid a lot of money to do something and then you're given, your ego's inflated to say you're doing the good thing, then, you know, they're going to have much more incentive to basically not look at the bad information.
So ego definitely in there.
Oh, massively. But also, I mean, some of the ones I've debated on X have just startled me at just the illogical statements that they make. A lot of them don't tend to understand behavioral science, because if you understood behavioral science, you'd realize that we can all fool ourselves.
Mm.
Yeah. And Richard Feynman, who's one of the greatest scientists of all time, he said, the first principle is to not to fool yourself, and you're the easiest person to fool.
Yeah.
You know, and but a lot of them don't appear. I mean, some of them make statements that totally violate scientific principle, but because it makes them feel good and it makes their, you know, their group better, they don't tend to mind that happening.
And many of them got public exposure, didn't they? They were on television networks nightly being interviewed, looking like and sounding like experts and having that ego fed.
Yeah. Well, that's very problematic. And that was the whole part of that hero worship that was going on. That if you're suddenly got your fear, because think about many doctors and nurses, they were under so much pressure for so many years. And then all of a sudden they got the attention, you know, they're sort of 15 minutes of fame. And then, you know, it's easy for the person, it's, you know, power and sort of hero worship is very seductive. And they just really didn't, a lot of them didn't ask the questions they needed to ask.
It was kind of like, I've been to, you know, those sort of hypnotist shows, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And they're very entertaining. But people, you can see the way they're selected. Some people don't pass the selection. They go back into the audience. And very quickly, you've got a group of people who they're sitting there who are very susceptible to being persuaded to do things and crazy things, like endlessly putting on ties through the whole night every time a particular tune plays. Reason I'm mentioning that is I was thinking at the time that it did feel like some kind of mass hypnotic event. Anything in that?
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's a lot of compelling evidence about that. I mean, hypnosis is a very wide subject. But from the people that did, you know, just follow along, and these TV doctors that just told us all sorts of crazy things, you're always going to find someone that's just going to do as you say, okay? And if they let those ones speak and they silence the others, that's effectively what happens. And a lot of these systems, they wean out the people that ask difficult questions.
Yeah.
You know, for instance, in Japan, in the Reserve Bank, if you ask difficult questions, the journalists ask difficult questions, they don't get invited back next year. So they end up self-censoring. So then what you've got is you've got a group of people in a room and no one's going to say anything. You get the emperor's new clothes.
Yeah.
And then you get the doctors that have said, right, we're going to pay you a load of money. You know, we want you to say this. And they just go along with it. And they will rationalize to themselves that, okay, I'm helping people out, so it's fine.
We have in New Zealand, a sort of an offshoot of the behavioral insights team, the BIT here. While we have a team like that still in operation, we're still in trouble, aren't we?
Well, there doesn't have to be. You see, behavioral science is a very powerful tool.
Yeah.
And just like a hammer or a drill, it can be used for a lot of really good things. It's really who's using the tool and for what end. That's the point. It shouldn't be used without people's knowledge or consent, which it is being done all the time. It's going to create a massive blowback, but I think it's really revealing itself now. You know, in governments, I mean, since the dawn of time, people always need to be wary of their governments. You know, the US Constitution was written to protect the people from the government, right? Yeah. That was the whole point.
Yeah.
But somehow we, you know, this naivety that you're going to get a group of very powerful people that are going to hand the power back, or they're not going to misuse it.
Or want more.
I mean, the evidence.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the evidence shows us that it's not used in an ethical manner. You know, it's clear.
We've been following events in the UK, and I mean, countries all around the world are having events, but in the UK, given our connection and a lot on social media, are you seeing this kind of nudging, this kind of approach at work when it comes to talking about far rightists, immigration, now banning smoking at pubs, which, Nigel Farage is not happy with. So this is a continuation of the same style of nudging and persuasion still going on.
Yeah, and much, much more. Oh. I mean, you can't walk in a supermarket now without noticing the changes that are occurring, and they're occurring very quickly. So if the changes occur very slowly, then a lot of time people won't notice. But the thing is with this far right narrative, I mean, it's going to have no meaning soon, you know, because it's just being used and worn down, and everyone's getting quite bored of it now because it doesn't really mean anything anymore. And the other question is, I think if you ask the average member of the public what constitutes being far right, I don't think they'd be able to give you an answer.
Mm.
I think the media's just done a good job of saying this is bad, and people then go, oh, yeah, that's bad. But yeah, Starmer's really pushing it. I mean, the cigarette thing, I mean, who is he to tell anyone how they can live their life? You know what I mean? The craziness that people would accept it.
Well, it's to keep us safe, isn't it? There's that one that comes in, safe and protected and sort of protected by mummy and daddy, you know, stay.
Yeah. Well, because the thing is, remember we go back to the start when I said they stopped listening to people and they started watching them.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's actually a very good thing to do in life. Don't listen to what someone says. Watch what they do.
Yeah.
Because by their actions, you get a lot more information. So Starmer, I saw an interview today, actually, where Starmer was talking about elderly pensioners who were cold and they wouldn't get out of bed late. And he's just taken the winter allowance away from them.
Yeah, we know about that. Yep.
Which is like, so he said he cared. And his actions showed that he didn't give a shit, to be honest. And it wasn't so long ago in the UK that everything was about saving granny. Mm-hmm. But now he's quite happy to let her freeze to death.
Yeah.
You know.
And also sending huge money, if it's reported accurately, to other, what would you call it, projects and, wars and, you know, huge amounts, billions of pounds.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, massively. And in fact, you just reminded me there, one of the nudges that I saw last year, and I made an official complaint about it. And I, in fact, kicked up a stink in the shop. So I was in a supermarket and I just popped in for one thing. And I generally don't like a lot of the supermarkets. And I always try to go to the to be served by a human. But basically, I was in such a rush that I just went to the self-serve. And you know how sometimes it comes up with, would you like to donate?
Yeah.
Okay. At this particular one in M&S, they'd actually defaulted a pound donation to one of the war-torn countries.
Yeah.
And you couldn't take it off yourself you had to call a member of staff over to put in a code to remove it off.
Yeah.
Now, that's a use of nudge because I mean, most people won't want to be embarrassed by saying, excuse me, I don't want to donate a pound. So that's a classically unethical use of a nudge. And I'd say that most people probably wouldn't want to give the pound, but they know that they buy it with the sort of emotional manipulation. They're going to end up getting a lot more money.
Because they know that when you call the person over, you are declining the donation. It's obvious to everyone.
Yeah, exactly. So everyone around you.
It's made public.
Yes. And that's one of the biggest things of the manipulation is social proof. So they manipulated people into wearing the mask.
Yep.
I mean, I didn't wear one the whole through the pandemic. And I remember having an argument on a train once where one guy was following me onto the carriage, but he was only doing so he could pull his mask down because he didn't want to wear one.
Mm.
But he didn't want to be the only person not wearing one.
Uh-huh.
And then another gentleman gets on and then tries to give me a mask, right? And I'm like, thank you. So basically, those kind of things is that a lot of people would have worn the mask not to just stand out, and they don't like confrontation and they don't want to look like they're selfish. So that was a really emotional nudge, really, for pretty much every country around the world.
And it was known for quite some time before people stopped wearing masks that there was really no evidence to support their wearing in the first place. So,
and there never was. But you see, the thing that happens with the mind is that when you're forced to do something, you end up in dissonance. So then you'll start rationalizing, oh, it must work, et cetera, et cetera. So the people's brains were starting to move their belief systems without their awareness. So, I mean, you've probably seen the videos where people are screaming at people for not wearing a mask, you're putting me under risk and all this. But there never was any evidence. And it's just, it really is an amazing example of how when a lie is told regularly enough under certain conditions, people will just believe it.
Wasn't that Goebbels who said that?
Yeah, well, he said, I think, if the lie is big enough.
Yeah, and repeat it.
Just can't think, yeah.
Yeah, similar thing. for those listeners, and there'll be many of them, who have had difficult conversations with friends and relatives and really close family members, tried to be rational, tried to be reasonable, but still had problems. What do you suggest? Can you suggest some strategies that actually work that you can deploy, or is it just best to let time do its thing? What do you think?
Yeah, well, we've written a lot of documents on this, and we've made a lot of presentations. And there's a number of things. It's a bit like a golf shot. You just got to get everything in the right alignment. So the first thing is, if they think you're on the other side, they're never going to listen to a thing you say. So that's why the conspiracy theories, the far right, all these things are very powerful labels. Because effectively, for instance, let's say that you were standing there and someone come up to you wearing a mask and a pair of gloves on and wanted to give you some information, you'd probably just dismiss it straight away because it's like, hang on a minute, this doesn't fit into my reality. So the first thing is you've got to get what we say into a dialogue. So they've got to think that you're on the same side as them, okay? Now, you can demonstrate that, and I've even turned around and said it at times. So for instance, I was at one of the vaccination centers with a few of the lawyers, and this gentleman had come up because a few of the women had said the vaccine had some problems, and he had vaccinated his 16-year-old daughter. So he was, you know, and the ladies had said that to the daughter. So he's come up there and he's, you know, he's got a lot of energy, as you can imagine. And I just turned around to him and said, you know, let's have a conversation, but before we start, I just want to let you know we're on the same side. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, you're here because you care about your friends and family. That's why I'm here.
Right.
And straight away, the energy shifted, because what's going on is that the media are telling the public that anyone that doesn't do, you know, X, Y, Z, doesn't care. They're telling them all nasty things about this group of people. So when someone comes to talk to you, they're not really talking to you. They're talking to the caricature of what they think that person is, okay? Now, if we then get angry and start saying crazy things, then they're just going to call us crazy. That makes sense? So So that would be the first stage, is they've got to know, because you can't move someone's position, but if you align on principle, their position sometimes will automatically move. But that's the first thing. You've got to be on the same side, because all the studies show that groups will never listen to other groups if the group is in opposition to them.
Right.
Okay. There's a lot of studies done on this. So let's say you had in the US, for instance, the people that wanted the gun control and the people that were opposing it. Okay. So they're completely opposite ends of the spectrum. What they then did was produce very compelling, very scientific, very well articulated, information, and they provided it to the other side. You would expect people to come more to the middle, but in fact, they went further apart.
Oh.
Because when there's a gap, a big gap in the group identities, they never listen to each other. Makes sense? So you've effectively got to let the person that you're talking to know that you're in the same group.
Right.
So you find a way.
Which is what you did in the store or in the pharmacy or whatever. Yeah.
At the vaccination center. Yeah. So basically, yeah. I said, look, we are on the same side, and I explained why. They said, we need to talk about it. There's a number of other things as well. So it's a bit like you want to reach someone's rational mind to have a rational conversation. And at that particular point, you can start delivering information via stories, metaphors, and questions. But up to that point, you've got to navigate a lot of pitfalls. Okay. Mm. And what's happening is that unless you know what these pitfalls are, you're effectively trying to traverse this obstacle course with a blindfold on.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the other things is what we talk about is distance. And what that is, if you imagine, Paul, all the information that you've learned over the years, okay, and you imagine that information is in the form of a hotel, okay, and each floor is information that's layered on information, okay, then you'd be sitting in your penthouse on all the information that you'd built up over the years, okay, and then you're trying to talk to someone that hasn't even come in the lobby.
Yeah, right.
Okay, yep, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, what people are doing is that they're talking really advanced information, but the other person, they're so far away from what you've done on that subject, and anyone on anything could be that gap. And yes. it's basically called distance. So wherever someone is, you always have to have the information, what's known within an acceptable range of belief. Okay. So most people can understand that corruption exists. Most people can't really accept that things are being done on purpose.
Yeah.
Makes sense?
A lot of people say it's cock up, usually. It's a cock up, right?
But, of course, the real thing to do, and there's another thing here that's really important, this show, don't tell. So if someone come up to you and said, wear your mask, what's the thing that you would respond to? It would be like, get lost. And the same token is if someone valued a mask and you said take it off, you're going to get the same response, okay? But if you can show someone something, it has a very different effect than telling them, because we learn by observing things and then we build the conclusions from that. But by telling someone something, you're really only giving them the sort of headline, but they've not had the experience to get to that headline.
Right. I understand that. Yeah.
Now, one of the other really key things when you're talking to someone is that most people, the way that we've been educated, have a fear of criticism, okay?
Right.
And if they're criticized in any way, they react in a very angry manner.
Yeah.
And the minute that they get angry, they get into the emotional mind, and then all you're doing is having an argument. That makes sense. So there's a whole, and we have a document on this called The Do's and Don'ts in Conversation. And if you go through that document and just adhere to all those points, you have the realization of that when you talk to someone that believes similar things to you, it's going to be a completely different conversation.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you're talking to someone that's been highly conditioned to believe a set of information, you have to talk to them a very different way. And you've got to really navigate yourself around the things that they believe.
Yeah. And it might take time too, right?
Yeah. Well, the first thing to do is to really connect to the person.
Yeah.
Okay. Because a lot of people tend to listen to people that they feel good around. Yeah. A lot of the problem is that the information that we're delivering doesn't make people feel good.
No, it doesn't.
Now, yeah. Now there's a really, but it could make people feel empowered. Okay. See, this is a really key point because they've effectively put people in fMRI machines. They've measured the brain activity. So they know under what conditions people listen to and what they respond to. They respond very well to stories. We have this assumption that if we have something important that the other person needs to know, we assume that they want to know. But it doesn't actually hold up. They generally don't want to know bad information.
Yeah.
So we got to frame it in such a way that it makes them feel empowered or safer or better off. Because a lot of the time, people are just delivering the information in such a cold, difficult way that the person might feel that they're better off. You know, ignorance is bliss.
Yeah. I can see that. For folk on the other side, let's put it like that, who are kind of slowly waking up to a few things. How does that process work? And what can we expect? Because we're talking about a lot of people here. I mean, they aim for 95% here. I don't know if they got to it, but that's most of the population could be waking up to a very bad dream. What happens in those people?
Well, they need a lot of support. Right. So basically what happens is that we absorb information and there's certain information that we can't just fit into our existing viewpoint of the world. So things will happen. Like, for instance, somebody will have their uncle die in a car crash and they put COVID on the death cert and they just say, hang on a minute, that isn't right. And then what they do is they get a different view of the world. If they have enough experiences that contradict how we're told the world works, what tends to happen is that their whole worldview collapses. And that's what's happened to a lot of people the last 4 years. You end up at a crossroads pretty much then, and it's either PTSD or it's PTG. PTG is post-traumatic growth. So pretty much anyone that's become aware, I don't think anyone would actually, you know, that thing in the Matrix, they wouldn't take the red pill and go back or the blue pill and go back, would they? Because once you know about it, you can't go back. Mm. But what's really important on that, that's why the groups and having support is so key. Because once you've got enough support, then you can really grow. And in fact, you can build a new model of the world, a new viewpoint. Because most of us just have what we were told at school. Okay, and as pretty much hopefully most people are finding out now, that's not completely true in all areas, is it?
Gosh, Pink Floyd got it right with The Wall, didn't they?
They certainly did, yeah. I was thinking about that the other day, funny enough.
Yeah. Actually, there are quite a few songs from the past that apply. Animals is another great example, that album, the messaging in that. You can sort of overlaps what we've seen. That's absolutely fascinating, David. Thanks for coming on our program and talking about that as a sort of like an on-ramp to your arrival to New Zealand for the conference. Awesome. Which you'll be talking about these things, right? So this is through them.
And I think we've got a couple of workshops lined up as well for a couple of hours to talk about this, because it does take a good few hours to understand this subject, but it's time really well spent. Because when you understand behavior, you'll get to understand yourself better. You'll get to protect yourself from manipulation a lot more. And you'll also be able to phrase information to others that will resonate a lot deeper. Yeah. And you'll get people listening to you a lot more. For instance, I just come back from a conference in Canada, which is very fascinating because it's the first time I'd seen organized protesters. They were basically lying about people at the conference and trying to drum up some negative press, right, which was quite interesting.
Yeah, it is.
But we ran a few workshops there and we had a number of people that literally got through to others within a day or two by just completely changing their approach. So, you know, this thing, if what you're doing isn't working, you know, it comes back to the thing, if you're banging your head against the wall, then just do something else. And a lot of this information, which we've collated from a lot of different experts, really can help people slightly change their approach and hopefully have a lot more success in reaching others.
Well, hopefully I'll get to meet you in person. Looking forward to if not, it'll be the live stream, to meeting you, David Charalambous, renowned expert in communication and influence, coming on RCR this morning ahead of his visit to New Zealand for that conference. Fascinating chat, David. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.